Hi, good afternoon, everyone. This is Rajiv Askana for the Law Offices of Rajiv Askana PC, immigration.com. Today is Thursday, September 8th, 2011. This is a community conference call which is being recorded. This recording will be made publicly available, so if you do comment or ask a question, conceal your identity. There is no need for you to advertise who you are. We strongly encourage you not to say state your real names, etc. By participating in this call, you have not become our client, nor have we become your lawyers. This is merely an information session. That said, let me get started on the questions that have been posted. Let's see. The first question is from Saha511. He is confused about, or she is confused about, actually she is confused, it's Sasha, sorry, not Saha. Sasha wants to know what should I write in my no objection to return to India J-1 waiver, which local agency should I be contacting because I've lived in different states and I've studied somewhere else and my in-laws are somewhere else, et cetera, et cetera. So, well, first of all, I need to let you know that the last time I was directly involved with a NORI case was a good 8 or 9 years ago. The simple reason is lawyers have very little to do with these cases. This is basically an administrative process where you don't need the intervention of a lawyer. So we've not been involved. If I were to make a guess on what address you should put, I would say it is the same address that you were using at the time you prepared your 2019, your DS 2019, the form that you filled for J-1 visa. It used to be called IAP-66. So the address that you used at that time, I would go with that same address. Okay? I hope that that question is answered. Now, the next question was, what documents do I attach? Everything has to be obtained from the U.S., from the Indian consulate in USA. But you need to contact them. You need to download their forms. They will tell you what forms, what documents you need to attach. I don't know. I have no idea. Next question is Houston Krishna. His parents were in USA for 1 year. Then they traveled out, and they want to come back again for 6 months. Well, here is the problem. Let's see. They first came in Feb 2010. They stayed till Feb 2011. And now after 6 months in India, they want to come back. Well, I have a feeling that the CBP officers are not going to like it. If they don't like it, they can actually turn them away from the airport itself, which means without letting them come into USA, they can tell them, look, you have two options. We're not going to let you enter USA. You have two options. Either we turn you away, what is formally referred to as exclusion, and then you can't come back for 5 years, or you withdraw your application for admission and return on the next flight back. So in either case, it's a very real possibility that they will not be allowed to come back into USA. I don't know if they don't notice that these folks have been here for a year and they're coming back after 6 months, that's different. I would certainly be very, very hesitant to bring my parents back in that quickly. I would say at least a year, year and a half, they should be outside USA before you bring them back in. And, you know, 1 year is too long. A visitor visa or a tourist visa is supposed to be for tourism, according to the government. And if you have people who are actually touring India and staying in USA, that doesn't work. Okay? So be careful with that. Have them stay outside USA as long as possible, 2 years if possible, but at least a year and a half or more, you know, somewhere in that neighborhood, I would say. Next question is Shazbel. Recently interviewed for a position in my university for a software programmer. I'm on H4. Requested an H-1. It takes 3 to 4 months to get approval. Well, you can always pay for the premium processing. There is no requirement that the university has to pay for it. You could pay the $1,000, $1,200 that it takes to get the case premiumed. Then you have your approval within a few weeks. Okay? Next is it okay to work on voluntary basis? I would discourage that because if you look at the definition of unauthorized employment, it covers situations where work is being performed for cash or kind. So if you get any kind of benefit out of it, it can be considered to be unauthorized employment. if you're not getting anything out of it, cash or kind, maybe it's okay to volunteer. But I feel very hesitant under these circumstances to advise people to work voluntarily, because USCIS has never squarely addressed this issue. So bottom line, avoid it. Just premium the case. The project for which they are hiring is a grant-based 8-month project. Is this a problem? No. You will get an H-1 for only 8 months. What are the guidelines for H-1 transfer while on a university H-1? I'm not sure what you mean by that. If you're asking me that I'm on a university H-1 and then I want to transfer to a private employer, am I subject to a quota? The answer is yes, you are. So you'll have to go by the quota. If there's quota available, which there is usually these days, then you're okay. Anjali wants to know, I entered into USA on a different visa other than H-1. Then I changed status to H-1. For 1 year, worked, and then moved back to India. Okay. Instead of H-1 transfer, my new employer filed a new H-1 recently. Can I use the same visa? I would say don't use it. Okay. Typically, if there is a visa stamp on the passport, you should be permitted to use that to travel. But my concern is these days with the USCIS, CBP, and the consulates coming down so heavily upon H-1 visas, it makes me a little uncomfortable. Does the law permit it? Yes. Do they have the discretion at the border, at the airport, to challenge your visa? Yes. Yes. What would be the grounds? I don't know. Because I know of cases recently in New Jersey where people had legitimate visas and still they were turned away. Okay. So I would just be very uncomfortable letting anybody use the same visa after 1.5 years for another employer, especially when they've been outside USA. Can you use it? Probably yes. Legally, yes. Can there be problems at the port of entry? Yes, there can be. And I'm concerned about that. And also keep in mind, if you go to get a new visa stamping, it's very, very difficult these days to get an H-1 visa stamp. Okay? So you have to balance all these things. If you come in and they create a problem for you, what happens then? Or versus going and taking a chance on a new H-1 stamping, which you might never get. So, okay? So, Anjali, you have to kind of strike a balance there. Next question is about a citizenship interview for an asylum person. Look, I don't know anything about political asylums, but let me see if I see what is going on. I got my green card through asylum because you got from an immigration judge, okay? I was technically in deportation proceeding. My question is, should I answer yes to the question, have you ever been due? The answer is yes. You should answer yes. Have you ever requested a relief? The answer is yes. The relief was the political asylum. Okay? So you will say that you requested relief and the relief was granted and that you got political asylum through the immigration judge. So have you been in deportation proceedings? Yes. Did you request relief? Yes. Explanation? I applied for political asylum before an immigration judge and I was given the political asylum. Next question, Dame. Every time we relocate out of current geographical location, then we need to apply H-1B. Is that right? No. No. Let me try to explain the rules in as simple a way as I can. First of all, if you travel or if your job changes within normal commuting distance, 10, 20, 30, 40 miles of the LCA approval spot, you don't have to do an H-1B amendment as long as the job description, title, etc. remains the same. You only have to do an LCA, a new LCA. So relocation within the same area, only LCA amendment, no problem with the USCIS. But if the movement or the relocation is beyond normal commuting distance, you are moved from Arkansas to Texas, you have to do an H-1B amendment, okay? So first rule, simple, within same area, no amendment, only LCA. Not within the same area, amendment. Now comes the travel rules. There are some travel rules. There are certain kind of employments called peripatetic employments. Peripatetic, P-E-R-I-P-A-T, peripatetic, P-A-T-E-T-T-I-C, peripatetic, okay? In peripatetic employment, what we are saying is that the nature of the job is such that you have to travel. For example, traveling salesman. I'll give you an example. We have a client here in Washington, D.C., a company that does security checks on IT infrastructure. So typically their boys are working 4 days in one place. They'll go in, they'll check the routers, they'll check the firewalls, they'll check the intrusion detection systems, whatever these companies are doing, and then they're gone. So they keep traveling from place to place, never working more than a few days in one spot. How can you do LCAs for something like that? Well, that's where the peripatetic employee comes in. If your job is such that it requires frequent travel, you have to file your H-1 as a peripatetic employee, and you have to inform the government that I'm going to be a peripatetic employee. Remember one thing. The rule is you must not work at one client site for more than 5 consecutive business days. There are other rules here, but I'm giving you a very brief rundown. So if that is your situation, you are a peripatetic employee. And the third thing that you need to remember is, in any 12-month calendar period, you are allowed to work in one area for 30 days without posting a new LCA. So let's say you work in New York and you have to go work in Washington, D.C. for 29 days, okay, in the month of March 2011. From March 2011 to March 2012, you can work only one more day in Washington, D.C. area. So total of 30 days in one 12-month period. And you can do that for every area in the country. But there is also an underlying rule that you must never misuse these provisions to get around the law. If it's a genuine case, occasionally you have to do it, that's fine. But you start doing it as a living, as a practical matter, you're going to create problems for yourself and your employer. Okay? I hope that makes things a little bit clearer. What is an H-1B dependent company? That's something you have to look up, the exact definition. It's different for different sized companies, but the general rule of the thumb is 15%, 1/5, of the employee workforce, if they are H-1 holders, then it's an H-1B dependent company. What are the things that employer has to do? They have to do certain additional things if they are an H-1B dependent company. Typically, they have to advertise and make sure that they've tried to recruit locally. And they have to also, before they place you somewhere, they have to find out if that client has laid off any people before they hired you and after they hired you. It's a 90-day window, I think, if I remember correctly. So this is called secondary displacement. They have to make sure that there's no secondary displacement. They have to make sure that they've advertised. And there's 4 kinds of advertising: direct advertising, indirect advertising, active and passive. So there's all kinds of things they have to do. But if they pay you $60,000 or you have a master's degree, then you don't, you're not covered by those rules. USCIS blacklisted companies. There is no such thing as blacklisted companies, but there is an official website where Department of Labor does list its enforcement actions, and that site is www.foreignlaborcert, foreignlaborcert, .doleta, D-O-L-E-T-A, Department of Labor Employment Training Administration, .doleta.gov/quarterlydata.cfm. I guess it's a cold fusion page. So quarterlydata.cfm. foreignlaborcert.doleta.gov/quarterlydata.cfm. That's the website. They have the data there about, you know, how many people have filed there, how many ETAs, et cetera, and any enforcement actions taken against employers. Other than that, there is no specific website that USCIS maintains that I know of. Okay? Next question that you have is EAD-related. 2-year AP on the same EAD card. I have multiple entry AP, but my EAD is less than 180 days. Will I get 2-year AP? I don't know, sir. I have no idea. This is a relatively new process. Other people in my firm will keep track of something like this. I don't know the answer to that question. Number two, EAD renewal instructions say people applied after July 30th does not have EAD renewal. Okay, again, I don't know anything about what the fees, et cetera, are. Other people in the firms take care of, in the firm take care of. I take care of the law part. Logistics and these minor details, other people take care of. Third question, are the PERM labor applications on hold due to state wage not published issue? Well, I think that issue has been resolved. At least we have seen some prevailing wages come fairly quickly. Otherwise, the turnaround time was expected to be as much as 6 months. But I think it's been taken care of, as far as I know. Yesterday, somebody in the firm in one of our meetings was talking about how they had received prevailing wages fairly quickly. So it may have been resolved. Next question is Jigri Pokri. He says, I'm a recent MBA graduate on OPT. He wants to do business. Well, you could do business on OPT as long as it is in your own field. But it's only as good as your OPT duration. After that, you cannot. Can you do an H-1 for your own company? The answer is yes. According to USCIS most recent frequently asked questions, you can do an H-1 for your own company as long as you have a genuine employment relationship. What does that mean? That means somebody can fire you. If you yourself own the company and you are everything in the company, then nobody can fire you. That's the take USCIS has. So if someone can fire you, you can do an H-1 for your own company. But startup companies have other problems. Okay? So it's not going to be an easy H-1. But it can be done theoretically at least. Can I do a green card through my own company? Not PERM. You can't do a PERM. Very, very difficult. But you might be under the new guidelines, not guidelines, but some policy statements USCIS has been making that we will allow entrepreneurs to do their national interest waivers, etc. You might be able to. Okay? Same question. Would be possible later on, possibility to do a green card? I just answered that question. PERM-based green card, no, but entrepreneurship-based green card, maybe, depending upon what detailed guidelines they provide. So far, we don't have detailed guidelines, just a general policy statement. Consultant 007, I-485 pending question. Can we expedite my pending 485? See, one thing I don't understand about your case is why is the Administrative Appeals Office involved? Was it because your I-140 or one of your I-140 was ever under appeal? If this is a mistake and no appeal has ever been filed, you need to contact USCIS and straighten this out because this doesn't make any sense. Okay? If the lawyers are saying that you have to wait, then obviously that, you know, there is an appeal somewhere that we don't know about. So if there's an appeal, you can contact your congressman's office and have them track it down. That's not a bad idea. Okay? Next question is Kashyap Mittal, I guess. Question number one, I'm on my sixth year of H-1B with an approved I-140. H-1B has been renewed for three-year extension beyond 6 years. 3 months leave of absence immediately after H-1 due to personal reasons. Returned, worked for 1.5 months, and resigned. Payroll was processed for these 1.5 months only post-resignation. Okay. Company attorney hadn't disclosed the LOA before handing the H-1B transfer. In response to the RFE, I'm planning to include the original letter requesting unpaid LOA, a letter from the... You must also describe... Look, I can't help you to this level of detail on how to answer an RFE. Generally speaking, your personal affidavit stating your motivation for seeking the LOA is very important. Okay? And I think you talked with me about allergic rhinitis, et cetera, as a partial reason. I can't go into this level of detail, but that's exactly what you'll have to do. And I don't know what this nunk pro tunk, it has absolutely no meaning what you've just said to me. Company attorney suggests to also include a nunk pro tunk. because it provides a no-cost insurance against potentially unfriendly legal framework? What the hell does that mean? I'm sorry, I don't even understand what this means. Look, what is nunk-pro-tunk? Nunk-pro-tunk simply means approval of a case based upon a prior date. Instead of doing it from current date forward, they do it from back date. So it's backdating an approval. Even if they don't backdate the approval, what is the big deal? I don't see any problem here. So again, I am confused. Maybe your lawyer has some facts that I don't. But the line that you have written, a no-cost insurance against potentially unfriendly legal framework, it means absolutely nothing. Those words mean nothing. Okay? So I'm not sure what the reasons are. You may want to check with your lawyer. I don't understand what the reasons for a nunk-pro-tunk are. No harm in asking. There's never a harm in asking. But I don't see the need for it. Question number two. If this H-1B transfer gets denied, can I use my approved I-140 to do a new H-1? Huh? You can always get 3 more years on H-1 as long as your I-140 is still approved and not withdrawn. The only problem is you will have to go outside USA to get your visa stamping if you're out of status. Next question. If this H-1B transfer gets denied, when does my out-of-status begin, retroactively or post-denial? It begins post-denial. Andrew wants to know if U.S. citizens, if green card holders can sponsor parents for green card, and the answer is no. Not until you become a U.S. citizen. But you may, well, we have done some cases where we were able to get a B visa for a parent when there was nobody else to take care of them. Technically, that applies only to people on non-immigrant visa. So let's say somebody's here on H-1 and their mom is home alone. They could get her here on a B-2. Does USCIS extend the same courtesy and the consulate extend the same courtesy to parents of green card holders? The answer is maybe. There really is nothing written down on this. There is something written down on getting B2 for people who are not qualified for H4, like parents. Okay? But there is no provision for, unfortunately, for parents of green card holders. You can try. Try to see if she can get a B2 to come and visit and then keep extending that indefinitely. I have one client for whose father we have extended a B visa, I think about 4 or 5 times. So he's been here like a 2.5 year time frame so far. And the reason is very clear. He's got advanced diabetes, and he needs some ongoing help, and there's nobody in India to help him. And both his kids are here. So, you know, it's worth trying. B visa may be the way to go. Suresh Mail wants to know, I got my green card in August 2011, I'm applying for GC through I-130 for my wife, who's in India. With a rough estimate, if her priority date is today, when can she expect her green card? I don't know. That depends upon the visa bulletin, Suresh. That depends. Visa bulletin time go up and down. Just keep track of the visa bulletin. I can't predict it. I mean, it went from 6 years to 6 months and back again to several years. So it keeps swinging to and fro. It's very difficult to predict it. Last question for the day, guys. Criteria for H-1 filing job requirements. What kind of positions would be eligible for H-1B visa approval? Would a technical support analyst position be qualified? Any position that requires at least a bachelor's degree in a specific subject. If the job does not require a bachelor's degree in a specific subject, then that job cannot get an H-1 for it. Okay? How do you prove that a job requires a bachelor's degree? Some jobs are obvious. Some jobs, for example, technical support analyst, one of the ways you could demonstrate is to show that the company has never hired and will never hire a technical support analyst who doesn't have a degree in computer science. Okay? So that's one of the ways you can prove it. There are several things you can do, but basically it comes down to proving that a bachelor's degree is required for the job. Okay? Anybody has any questions, please press *5 on your phone. Press *5 on your phone. Anybody who has a question, press star 5. Okay, one question, three questions. All right, let me get started. The first person that I'm going to unmute is somebody who has no area code, so they might be calling through Skype or through another voice over IP. You logged in at 1:57 p.m. Eastern Time. Go ahead. Say hello.
Hello. Can you hear me, sir?
I can hear you.
Okay, sir, thank you for answering my question. I'm the one who posted a question on starting a business.
Yes.
And sponsoring H1. So for a startup, how can someone someone show that this person can be fired? For example, would it help to have a board of directors who have oversight?
This is one of those things that's very easy to put down in theory, but very difficult to prove in practice. Okay? Remember, board of directors can be fired by the stockholders. Okay? And who's the stockholder? You are the stockholder. So, really, what USCIS is asking us is very difficult to prove. I guess what they are thinking is, an organization or a company where there are sufficient number of people involved, that the H-1 holder himself is not the only one who is the, you know, be-all and end-all of the H-1 of the corporation. Okay, so if there's 5-10 people involved who own stock in the company, we can think that, well, this person can be fired by these people. Okay, that's probably what they're thinking. Now, if we don't have that situation, then of course having a board of directors, having you know, somebody who's a CEO and you are maybe a vice president or something, that might help. But also remember, doing an H-1 for a startup company is by itself very difficult, because one of the things we have to prove is that the company has the ability to pay you. We don't have to prove it directly, but often during H-1 it becomes an issue. They'll ask you, where is the salary coming from? Okay. So to answer your question, can a board of director help? Yes, it can, but not a whole lot.
Okay. And then I have another question. Yep,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Hanji, sir, duja question se ja te fir kadi puch lena main tanu.
Ha, koi problem, jadon marzi puch lo.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Okay. I had two more hands up, but they're not up anymore. Once again, anybody has any question, press star 5 on your phone, star 5. Area code 640, go ahead. 650, go ahead, please.
Hello, sir. This is Vijay.
Yes.
My question is, during 2007, me and my wife, we applied for 485 and we are on EAD and advanced parole. But at that time, I was the dependent and my wife was the primary.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, my employer has a I-140 approved, and it has a priority date of 2005 of EB-2.
Right.
So how should we go about? Should we apply a new 485?
One thing, hang on. You have a 485 pending through your wife, correct?
Yes.
What is her priority date and what category?
Well, she is in EB-3 in 2004. But
okay. And you are EB-2 2005?
Yes, and it is current now. And
if I were your lawyer, I would file another set of 485s. You as primary, she as derivative, and I would make sure that these two get linked to the pending 485s as linked cases. So same AIM number must be used.
Okay.
Now, you could always just file the I-140 and USCIS is required to approve the I-485s even though you have them through your wife. So if your PD becomes current, they should approve both 485s that are already pending. But to avoid any confusion, I always file two sets of 485s.
Okay. Okay. Good.
That's what I would do.
Thanks a lot. Yeah,
you're welcome.
That.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Area code 224, one second. 224, go ahead, please.
Yeah, Rajiv, this is Sanjay here. You mentioned initially about not having any problem in the offer letter, employer mentioning any intent.
That is correct.
To
if the employer says we are going to process your green card for you, there is no legal issue as far as immigration law is concerned. You can put that in there, no problem.
Okay. Also, what is your view on someone having EB3 and EB2 simultaneous form processes going on for the person?
For the same employer?
No, different employers.
I don't see any problem with it.
Okay.
Okay.
Sure. Thank you, Riley.
You're welcome. Good luck. Area code 519. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. I can hear you.
Yeah, okay. Actually, I'm a Canadian citizen, and I would like to apply for E2 visa on an investment base.
Right.
And I have roughly net worth 100,000, mm-hmm. and I'd like to invest business like 50 to 80,000 range.
See,
in U.S.
Look, these are small numbers, and I'll tell you why. Typically,
okay.
First of all, the rule for E2 is very simple in theory. The rule is that your investment should be substantial in comparison to the cost of acquisition of the business. Okay? So let's say, and we've had this argument actually, there's a lot of confusion about this within the government also. I don't want to get into all the details, that'll take too long. There's a
right.
difference between cost of acquisition and cost of asset. So let's say you go and buy a motel. You only have to put down $300,000 for a $1 million motel. Okay?
Right.
So the cost of acquisition is really $300,000, not $1 million. The cost of the
okay.
asset is $1 million, but the cost of acquisition of business is $300,000. Canadian consulates are filled with people who are so confused about the law, it takes us forever to make them understand. They will say, well, you're putting in 100,000 as compared to, you know, let's say you are putting in 250. You're putting in 250 as compared to 1 million, 250 is nothing. And we tell them, look, 250 has to be compared to 300,000, not compared to 1 million. Cost of acquisition is only $300,000. And we are
right.
putting in $250,000. So first of all, they want to look at the relative cost of acquisition. And with the smaller amounts, the biggest problem is, an investment is supposed to be something that brings you living plus return of income. So return
right.
on income is also necessary. So if you put in $50,000 and you're only making $30,000 a year, that's not an investment.
Mm-hmm.
That's a living. So with smaller numbers, it becomes very, very difficult to get E2 visa stamping. Now, there is a case on the books many, many years ago where somebody was able to get an E2 visa with only a $50,000 investment, but that was a consulting business.
Oh, okay.
So chances of getting an E2 visa approval with this small amount
mm-hmm.
is very difficult, in my opinion.
Okay.
All right.
So
you have
shouldn't
to,
apply
you have
for
to
it,
be
right?
More in the $200,000-$400,000 range to even begin to think of E2 visa.
How about if suppose I have a partner over there, like let's say my sisters have a three business Dunkin' Donuts over there, and like if she wanna invest also in my business in a partnership, and it can maybe go rise the amount, would it work that way?
You may want to take a loan of that money instead of having them invest it.
Okay.
Because if you loan the money, I think your investment might rise to that level. I'll have to look at it. But I, off the top of my head, can think that it should work if you had a loan of that amount.
It should work.
Yep.
So can I show as a loan from my sister as well?
Yes. Why not?
So they will consider that, right?
Yeah. In fact, investment has to come from legal sources. This is true also for EB-5 cases, for investor visa cases. As long as the investment is coming from legal sources, it can be
okay.
loan, it can be a gift, it can be your own money, it can even be a promissory note
okay.
as long as it is secured by your personal assets.
Okay. And sir, one more question. Like, let's say if I'm investing money, let's say I'm applying for a E2 visa and I don't have a business ready yet. So how would I show in my application that, let's say, if they ask for the business details, I don't have any details yet. So how are we going
to
do that way?
The money has to be already put at risk. Otherwise, you don't get an E2 visa. In other words,
okay.
I'll give you an example. Let's say there was a motel you wanted to buy. Okay?
Okay.
Or a hotel you wanted to buy. And you came to me and you said, Rajiv, the deal is done. The seller is saying, give me $300,000 and we are done. I will never let you do that. I'll say, you tell the seller, I'll give you $310,000, $10,000 extra. But you have to wait until
right.
my visa is approved.
Okay.
So then what I'll do is I'll have you put your money in escrow. You know what escrow is, right?
Mm-hmm.
The money
yeah.
will go into escrow subject to only one condition, approval of E2 visa. If the
oh.
visa gets approved, the seller gets $305,000 or $310,000. It doesn't get approved, you
mm-hmm.
take your money home.
Oh, okay.
You don't want to be in a situation where you put the money in and then the visa doesn't get approved.
Yeah, we don't know about visa, right?
That's
so.
Right. So we always put the money in escrow. We never, ever let the clients put the money into business.
And like, I have my savings in my mortgage. Like, I have bought a house here, which is $185,000 right now, the valuation. And my loan is like $85,000 remaining. So, like, that $100,000, I don't have it in on my hand, but I have in my, like, my house. So,
see,
how would I show that?
That's not going to help you. That's going to be very That's going to be very difficult to prove and convertible into money. I mean, we can try, but that's a long shot. Especially
okay.
in the current
because
market.
Right now, I don't have an...
Yeah, you have to have the money in hand at least. I mean, you can get a promissory note based upon the asset, but then you get into fair market value of the asset. Is it really worth that much? You know, housing prices have fluctuated up and down so much. Actually, down so much.
Oh, okay. So that way it's not going to help me.
It's probably going to be a longer shot. Yes, sir.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay.
All right, guys. Anybody has a question, press *5. *5 on your phone. Two more questions. Area code 917. Go ahead, please, 917.
Hello, Rajiv. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, sir?
I'm okay. Thank you very much. I actually asked that question about leave of absence to you. I used my wife's account because for some reason the account that I had created last night did not let me post questions, so pardon me for that.
No problem.
And I'm the same person who asked the question about non-protunct also. Non-protunct is a new term to me, and I apologize for asking you the nonsense question. But here's what my lawyer had mentioned to me. He said that if, based on a personal level, if the USCIS official who looks at my H-1B transfer and the same person who's raised an RFE wants to approve your H-1B
It will be
transfer.
The same person.
Right.
The same officer will see it through. Okay. What else?
Okay. So if they want to approve it, but if there is some legal wrangling which prevents that person from approving the H-1, then in that case, non-protunct comes in and he's able to approve.
That makes absolutely no sense.
I apologize, but this is exactly what I heard.
Either you have misunderstood or your lawyer doesn't know what they're saying. One of the two things.
Okay. Most probably my lawyer is not really on top of all.
I hope they know what they're saying. I mean, if they...
Well, I hope so too.
Yeah, you know, otherwise we have a real problem. Look,
yeah.
If somebody has a license to practice in USA... 9 times out of 10, at least they have a basic level of competence. Because what you are telling me doesn't make any sense whatsoever. They may have said something different, though. To be absolutely honest about it, they may have said something totally different. But here, in this context, what you have described to me, nunc pro tunc makes no difference in my view. Asking for it doesn't make any difference either. Ask. Why not?
Okay, I'll do that. Another question that I have, and this question... you chose not to answer, and actually, I still want to ask you. This 1.5 month salary that I got paid after I joined my new company, it's
Look, let me explain to you something. Stop right there. salary paid in the future for work done in the past is not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it. When you did the work, you were on definitely proper H-1 with the company.
That's right.
So what if you got paid later? You got paid for work that was done while you were doing it legally. No problem.
Okay. 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 And you mentioned something about H-1B transfer getting denied, and then if I were to do a new H-1B,
you'll have to be outside USA probably.
Right. And this old I-140, is it still applicable to the new company, or does my company over here has to begin my LCA first, then I-140, and then do a new H-1B?
This is too complicated a situation for me to solve in 2 seconds, but chances are you'll end up going outside USA.
Okay. The last question that I have for you is, would you be able to handle or would you be willing to handle this case to help me with the RFE transfer?
Yes, but I'm not a magician. I'm just a lawyer. I can only do what I can within the limits of the law. I don't know how competent your lawyer is. If they are a competent lawyer, stick with them. But
well,
if you have any doubts about what they are doing, send me an email. Send me an email. We'll be happy to take the case for you.
Okay. Here's the case, Mr. Khanna. I did my LCA and I-140 through you guys. So it was through your office and actually...
The green card. You mean labor cert, not LCA.
Oh, labor cert, that is.
Okay.
That's true. And also the current H-1B that I'm trying to transfer was initiated from your office. And Jagdeep helped me with. When I changed the company, these guys actually went to another set of lawyers, and I asked them, are these lawyers competent? And they were very reasonably adamant about it. But now that I've received RFE, they actually...
RFE can come for anybody. Look, RFE's come in our office too. RFEs are a way of life. जैसे मंदिर में जाते हो प्रसाद मिलता है वैसे आरएफ वैसे यूएससीआईएस में पिटीशन डालते हो आरएफई मिलती है
अच्छा तो अगर मुझे क्या प्रोसेस मेरे लिए क्या प्रोसेस है आपको अगर इन्वॉल्व करना है
आई एम नॉट कंसर्न्ड बट लुक हियर इज व्हाट आई वुड सजेस्ट यू डू हैव अ हार्ट टू हार्ट टॉक विद योर एम्प्लॉयर्स मेक श्योर दैट दे आर कंफर्टेबल विद दीज लॉयर्स आप क्यों पैसे यू नो आई बी हैप्पी टू टेक योर मनी इट्स जस्ट दैट आई एम रिलक्टेंट टू टेक अ केस अवे फ्रॉम समबडी हु इज डूइंग अ गुड जॉब ऑलरेडी ओके If they are not doing a good job, absolutely, they don't deserve the case. Hamare liye to aapka interest is primary.
Right.
We're not concerned about the lawyer. We are concerned only with the client.
The thing is, the attorney they assigned to me essentially feels like he only has a couple of years of experience. And that's my only concern.
No, that's no good. You need somebody who has experience as well as a team of people behind him who's supervising him also.
Exactly, which is why I was asking you.
No, there's no problem. Just contact my office, talk to Anna, or send me an email. You must have my email address, right?
Rajiv.
Just send it to help@immigration.com. It's as simple as that.
I actually have emails from you, so I must have it.
Yep. So just forward it to me, whatever you want us to do. Make sure there's enough time because I know that the team is pretty busy.
Okay, I'll actually send it right away. I'll send that email to you and copy Anna on it. Is that good?
Absolutely, no problem. We'll take care of it for you.
Thank you.
Anytime. Good luck.
Thanks.
Okay. I have a lot of people just remembered some questions, I guess. Four more questions. 1 second. Okay. Next is 612. Go ahead, please. 612. Area code 612. Area code 612.
Hey, Raju. Can you hear me?
You're a little bit on the... low side. Can you speak up a little bit?
Okay. Hi. Thank you for the service. I have one quick question.
Yes, sir.
My H-1B, I will be going for H-1B stamping. And if it's rejected, if I come in AP, what is the consequences?
I don't see any problem with it at all.
Okay. I still want to be on H-1.
You are on H-1. Even after you come back on AP, you are still on H-1.
Oh, okay, so there is no need for refiling?
The only time that can change is if you go apply for a visa, and not only is your visa denied, but the consulate sends the H-1 back for revocation. You can still use your AP. Then what happens is USCIS will send a notice of intent to revoke to your employer in 5-6 months, giving them 30 days to respond why they should not revoke the case. for information that was developed at the consular interview. Your 485 process still goes on. Even if the H-1 is revoked, it should not affect your 485. So, overall, I don't see any problems with it.
Okay, thank you.
Now, if you want to be even more secure, don't apply for a visa. You don't need to. Just use your advance parole to come back. If you use your advance parole to come back, you are still on H-1.
Okay. Yeah, actually, my company, they want me to go for stamping.
Explain to them what I just said. Not a good idea, because if the consulate find any excuse to send the papers back for revocation, they will take you out of H-1. Again, that's not the end of the world, but still, why go and, you know, take this chance? What is the point of it?
Okay, got it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck. Okay, two more questions. One is again from the same person who's on voice over IP. Now phone
yes.
number. Yes, go ahead, please.
Right. It's the same person who asked you about the startup business.
Aha, bolo.
So, मुझे आपसे कुछ guidance चाहिए था. I've been in the U.S. for a very long time, but
you do this. If you want a one-on-one consultation, just send me an email.
Hanji.
To help@immigration.com. Tell me what the questions are, and I will set up a call for you.
ठीक है sir. Thank you sir.
And I usually don't charge students for my time.
Okay. Thank you so much, sir. Thank you.
Good luck. All right. Bye bye. Last question, area code 201. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Rajiv. This is Drew here for the visa for my mom.
Yes, Drew. How are you?
Good, Rajiv. The thing is, though, she already has a multiple 10-year entry B2 visa, but that expires in...
Drew, why don't you do this? When she comes in, apply for a B visa extension.
Okay.
Okay. And give the reason very clearly that, look, I want her to stay with me as long as possible, because she's alone by herself in India. And there is actually, if you go to Google Foreign Affairs Manual.
Okay.
It should bring you to the State Department website where they have Foreign Affairs Manual. In Foreign Affairs Manual, somewhere under Section 42, you will see, I think it's 42, rules about tourist visas. And there they have a whole set of rules about when a dependent visa is not available and tourist visa is given instead. For example, gay partners. Okay? Can't get an H-4, but we'll give you a tourist visa.
But what happens in the case when the visa is actually, let's say, 10-year visa expires and then you cannot get an extension then, right? Or can you still?
Well, the fun thing is that visa only gets you to the border of the U.S. Stay is given by USCIS. So once you're inside USA, even if your visa is expired, if USCIS so wishes, they can keep giving you extensions.
Okay, so even let's say by the time I can get extensions until I get citizenship and then apply for green card.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. But keep one thing in mind. There is a downside to this process. If her visa is expiring within the next couple of years or 3 years or 4 years, the problem is, consulates don't like people extending their visas too long. Okay? So they might give her hassle about any future visas she might need. If she doesn't need a visa for the next 5-6 years, we have nothing to worry about. You're going to get your citizenship anyway.
Okay. But will it be a problem for her getting a green card, though, or this doesn't have a
no.
problem on you?
No. Here's the interesting thing. If somebody is married to a U.S. citizen, or they are the spouse or the child of a U.S. citizen, even if they have been unlawfully present in USA for 20 years, as long as they entered USA legally, and they don't travel until they get their green card, they will get their green card without any problem.
And then after the green card, everything is wiped clean, they can travel?
Everything is wiped clean.
Oh, excellent. Okay. So it's a good option, though, so it helps.
Keep all of these things in mind. You know, these are some of the things that... unfortunately, many years ago, we were involved very actively in the V visa, which was actually for spouses of green card holders. And it existed for about 2 years, but then it sunset. and it was never activated again. That was a great option. We could have, if it had stayed on the books, we could have extended it to parents also. Nevertheless, that's where we stand. So tourist visa seems to be the only option that I can see.
All right. Thank you, Rajiv.
Okay. You're welcome. All right, folks, it looks like we are done for the day. Good talking with all of you, and I'll see you again in 2 weeks. Oh, there's one more question? No, there isn't. Okay. All right, folks. Oh, two more questions. I'm confused. What's going on? All right, I'll take two more questions, then no more. Area code 703, go ahead, my neighborhood.
Hello, Rajiv. This is consultant 007, question number 10, Rajiv. So,
yes, Mr. Bose,
you know,
how can I help you?
Rajiv, I have a question about my I-485 pending, you know. Both my, you know, EB3, you know, I-140 has been approved, and EB2 I-140 has been approved. My 485 is still pending. You know, the lawyer sent an interfile letter, and you know they signed the GT.
How does the administrative appeals office come into this? Doesn't make any sense.
Yes, Rajiv. So basically, you know, like when I, you know, actually the EB3 labor was an, you know, the labor substitution. You know, back in 2007, I did a labor substitution. So that I-140 was denied. And when it was denied, my I-485 went to, you know, administrative appeals office for review purpose. But they didn't, you know, they still, you know, it was still pending all this
year. Your priority date is current right now?
Yes, sir. Yeah, EB3. After that, you know, they refiled the EB3 that got approved with 2003 priority date, and after
why
that,
don't
EB2
you file
also.
A new 485? Why don't you file a new 485?
You know, that will expedite the process, or how does it work?
I think so. As long as you create an explanation and let them know why you are doing it, absolutely.
Okay. Sure, sir. But this will take a while, right? I mean, you know, in order for us to, you know, get the current, you know, I-485, which is with the AAO, that will take a while, or how does it work?
I'm not sure why it is still stuck there and for how long it's going to be stuck there. I have no way to know that.
Okay.
It seems like an excessively long time if it's more than a couple of months.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, Rajiv. Yeah. Sure, Rajiv. Yeah. No problem. Thanks.
Good luck.
Yeah.
All right. Last question, area code 480. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Rajiv. My question number 12,
mm-hmm.
regarding the I-130 filing
mm-hmm.
to my wife.
Mm-hmm.
Can I, after filing 130, can I bring my wife on visiting visa?
Very difficult.
Okay.
Not impossible, but extremely difficult.
Okay.
Almost impossible.
Okay, okay. And
but that is true even if you don't file the I-130, because there's a question on the form DS-160 that says, is your husband or fiancé in USA? And the answer is yes, they won't give you the visa.
Okay. And I heard one more thing. Nowadays, wives and kids are exempted per country quota?
No, there's no such thing.
Okay.
As far as I know, everybody is the same quota. They have to inherit your priority date.
Okay. It is, right now it is 2008, so it will take 3 years if I file 130 for her?
I don't know. So whatever the visa bulletin times are, there you can estimate.
Okay. You said it came to 6 months before. No,
yeah, for a while there it was like 6 months.
Okay.
After many years, after almost a decade of being 6-7 years, it came down to 6 months. Then it went up again.
Okay.
All right?
Okay, thank you.
Good luck. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Folks, thank you all for being here. I'll see you again in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.